Good morning.
Good morning.
As many of you know, we're in the middle of a practice period right now. It's a time of intensive study. And Joe, who's cooking today, is leading us in the study of the precepts. Sometimes we call it precepts, but sometimes we call it sila. It means ethical behavior, or how we relate to the world, how we relate to other beings and to the world. This is part of the threefold practice, it's called. The threefold practice is meditation, what we did this morning, and knowledge, awareness and knowledge, and also our behavior, or how we exist in relationship to beings and things. So at this time, we're studying the precepts, or the way that we are in relationship to beings and things. It's a big topic, it's an enormous topic, and it's quite a big deal, and it's important study. This afternoon we're going to be having another workshop, or not a workshop, but a discussion group on the precepts, and everyone is invited to participate in that. What I'd like to talk about a little bit this morning, very simply, is not the precepts themselves, but a kind of view or attitude to how to be in relationship, or how to be in the world, or how to behave, how to grow up and behave. A kind of an approach, a different approach. Not so different, but I'm not exactly going to be talking about the precepts, but about how we meet the precepts. So I'd like to start in this traditional way, some talks are begun with a teaching, with an older teaching. This was a teaching, a koan or kangan, that was spoken maybe more than 1,000 years ago, a conversation. It's from case number 12 of the Shoyuroku, or the Book of Serenity. And here's the case, here's the conversation. Daizhang asked Zhuishan, "Where do you come from?" Zhuishan said, from the south." This is like a visiting monk who's come to the temple, or the place where Daizhang is the teacher. Daizhang said, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" Zhuishan said, "There is extensive discussion." Daizhang said, "How can that compare to me right here, planting the fields and growing rice to eat?" Zhuishan said, "What can you do about the world?" Daizhang said, "What do you call the world?" That's it. We're left with that question in this dialogue. What do you call the world?
Yeah.
That looks interesting too. This week I was with a friend and we were painting, doing some interior painting, and we were having a conversation. And this person said something that was very interesting to me. This person said, happiness is an inside job. And that really struck me. I kind of like that. Happiness is an inside job. We can all relate to that. We have to find our own happiness, or we have to, without outside, we can't look for our happiness necessarily outside of ourselves. We have to make our happiness within us. Makes sense. But it's a great saying. Happiness is an inside job. And I thought about that for a while. And I said, no, it's not. Happiness is an outside job. And then we got into kind of a discussion about inside, outside, what it all means. And very interesting, very stimulating. And, you know, of course, we're both right and we're both wrong. But think about that and have a serious talk like that is very interesting. And while we were painting, there was music playing in the background. There was music. I don't listen to very much music, and I almost never listen to country music. This was a country music singer called Lucinda Williams. Do any of you know Lucinda Williams? Yeah. She's really great. She's kind of raw, and she's like this real strong person that just opens herself up. And, you know, it's a great singer, great songs. And so kind of coincidentally, while we were having this discussion, Lucinda Williams was singing this song, When I Look at the World. And first of all, I should say, for those of you that don't know Lucinda Williams, she's kind of she's kind of like Bob Dylan. She's a complainer. She's really good at, oh, this is wrong, and that's wrong, and this is what's wrong with the world, and so on. She's, but with real heart, you know? I mean, she really knows how to let it all out, and she's great. Is that a friend of yours right there?
It must be.
Is it a spider?
Yeah, I think it came out my hair. Time to take a shower.
So this is kind of an example of. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Your friend?
Yeah.
Jen is very famous for. She takes care of animals here, and they just kind of come to you. Here's an example. This is the first refrain. I've been out of luck. I've been talked about. I've been locked up. I've been shut out. I've had some bad dreams. I feel real regret. I've made a mess of things, and I've been a total wreck. I've been disrespected and taken for a ride, been neglected, and had my patience tried. And here's the chorus. And then I look at the world in all its glory. I look at the world, and it's a different story each time I look at the world. Isn't that great? What do you call the world? Happiness is an inside job. Happiness is an outside job. I think we could all confess that we're our own favorite topic, and we're really interested and absorbed in me, in my story, my world. We're really good. We're experts at selfing, it's called. I think we're all familiar within ourselves and in relating to other people as well, that we all have a tendency, or we've had times when we've had a tendency to be kind of radically self-absorbed, and this is our world. But what is the world? My sister, my sister died a few years ago, but my sister was also a Buddhist practitioner, and she and both her husband, the people that they socialized with were mostly Buddhists in the Shambhala tradition. They noticed whether people were Buddhists or not Buddhists, whether they were practitioners or not practitioners, that most of the people that they talked to, not most of the people, but many of the people they talked to, usually when they talked to these people and had conversations with these people, mostly what they talked about was themselves. What they were doing, what they were talking about, what their story was, what their opinion about this and that was, what was going on with them. And they very rarely or only occasionally or exceptionally would say, well, what's going on with you? How are you doing? Or something like that. And my sister and brother-in-law called them 90-10 people. So they would, in relating to other people, they would spend 90% of their energy, whether it's vocal or whatever, about talking about themselves or reflecting on themselves or telling the world about themselves. And only 10% of their energy would be in actually inquiring how are you doing, or what's going on with you, or I'm concerned about you. You look a little, you know. So they would. I remember when I was visiting her years ago. She and her husband came home from a party, and they assigned a party, and they said, "Oh, that person, that's a 90-10 person." So I had to find out what that meant. So I think we can all relate to that, right? That we've met people like that. They're very interesting people, but they're just interested basically in themselves and telling you what's going on with them. And some people, when they talk about themselves, they might talk about themselves in a positive sense, which is a way one way of being sort of self-absorbed or self-interested. They say, "I did this and I did that," or "I'm this way or I'm that way." But some people actually seek to make a connection or relate to other people by talking about themselves in a negative sense. So they'll say, "Oh, this is wrong with me. I've had all this, you know, problems," or I've got this injury and I'm feeling miserable. And same thing. I mean, it's still 90%, whether it's positive or negative. So that's what Lucinda Williams was doing here. So here's the second refrain. She keeps going with this stuff. She says, "I've been used. I've been in the blue. I've been abused. I've been lied to. I've been left behind, and I've been misunderstood, and out of my mind and not feeling good. I've been lost. I've been turned away. I've paid a cost, and there's been hell to pay." And then I look at the world in all its glory. I look at the world, and it's a different story when I look at the world. So, let me tell you about me. I've got problems. Everybody's got problems, right? And they're really important. And the story, the great drama of me is like, how can it not be interesting to all of you? There's another koan, traditional story that is rather well known. Where is it? It's called Yunmen's Everyone's Light. Yunmen was a Zen teacher who was kind of famous for asking a question to his assembly, and then, I don't know, if before anyone had a chance to answer, he would answer his own question. Or maybe his assembly was, they were all really stupid or afraid, or they couldn't answer his question. I don't know. But anyway, as it's come down to us, he's a lot of his teachings, he answers his own question, and it does in this one as well. So this is called Everyone's Light. Yunmen said to the assembly, "All people are in the midst of illumination. Or another translation of this was, everyone is a light. But when you look at it, when you try and look at it, you don't see light. You see darkness or shades of gray. How is it then being light? How is it then being a source of illumination? What's it like? Where is that? Where is that light? And so we ask this question to the assembly, and I ask you, where is your light? Where's the light of your being? And since no one answered in the assembly, except that spider, Yunmen answered, and he said, the monastery hall, the garden gate, the kitchen. That was the answer. Where is your light? Where is the light of you? Is it some kind of secret place inside you? Or is it in the touching and the meeting of things? Of the being in relationship? Is it walking down the path? Is it talking to a friend? Is it signaling to change lanes as you're driving down the freeway? Is it catching a breath? Is it folding your laundry? Here's some commentary on that. The pure light encompasses the whole universe, existing right here now. Why is it then that you cannot see it? Being in the midst of illumination means the light is not shining on anything, does not exist for the light to shine upon. The light contains everyone, and everyone contains light. See, there are no shadows to be found anywhere. Since no one in the assembly can respond, Yunmen rolls it out for them. And before anyone can create a nest, in a flash, he snatches it away. He wants it to be clear that it is because Avalokiteshvara is the embodiment of compassion, is deaf, dumb, and blind, that she cannot wield the 10,000 hands and the eyes of great compassion. And the verse that follows this goes this way. When you point to the light, there also arises darkness. When you point to the dark, there also arises light. When light and dark are both forgotten, the 10,000 hands, the 10,000 eyes, the functioning of compassion, the functioning of relationship, spontaneously appears. and I look at the world and all its glory, however, I've been, this is the third refrain, I want you to know, I've been unforgiven, I've been let down, I've had my truth hit, I've been kicked around, I've been wasted, I've been on the brink, had my faith tested, and my spirit sank. I've been unwelcomed, I've been unloved, I've been cheated on and made a fool of. And then I look at the world and all its glory. I look at the world and it's a different story when I look at the world. I just hope that knowing that happiness is an inside job, really, that and we do have to work on ourselves and be self-empowered, that we can do what Dogen said. He said that to practice an attempt to confirm existence. You brought this up the other day. To practice an attempt to confirm existence by conveying a self to it is delusion. For existence itself to come forward as practice and confirm you is awakening. So the invitation as we negotiate the way is to get off the high horse of me and walk like a commoner. We don't have to be a marquis, a noble. Let's get off the horse, the high horse of me, the hobby horse of self, and walk like a commoner and meet the world. Enjoy the world. Appreciate the world. Touch the world. How's that for a proposition? Any thoughts? Anyone like to say anything?
I'm visualizing knee slapping music, but I don't know what the tempo is. So maybe you could hum it or something.
She'll be in San Francisco in a couple of weeks if you want to go see her.
Will she?
Yeah.
This is her new song from a new album. I've been out of luck. I've been talked about. I've been locked up. Give me some help here. I've been shut out. Oh, I can't do this anymore. I need some backing too.
I know a lot of her music, but the earlier stuff.
And then I look at the world in all its glory. Oh, she just complains and goodbye. Yeah. Wow. And then the whole thing lifts up, and then I look at the world in all its glory. Or maybe it's not glory, you know. I just look at the world. I just see what's going on.
It's a topic that you're talking about that's preoccupied my thoughts for a long time because of this practice, but in particular because of the practice I did before, which was being an artist. A lot of artists are quite egotistical, self-centered.
I've noticed that too. I'm an artist, so yeah.
So
and the rest
and
of
yet, some of them, it's almost a prerequisite for what they produce. They're so self-absorbed that that's how they're able to, you know, like James Brown. And it's amazing. So it's a quagmire for me to, you know.
That self-interest is a criteria for creativity that you
not,
think?
Not as a formula, but that I see it, Steve Jobs, you know, you go on and on, list of people. Not that every artist or great artist is, but I want to say, what did you say, 90-10? A lot of them are completely, utterly, it's all about me. And yet the outcome is great beauty.
Great self-absorbed beauty.
Yeah, but you know, still torturous, maybe. I don't know.
I read a book once called The Mind's Best Work that that talked about the creative process. I think I loaned it to you, Michael. Yeah, and it's creativity, not just artists, but scientists or anyone who does research, problem solving, investigation. And it talks a lot about the intuitive process. So it does it. And my sense from that book, it actually comes. The actual engine or impetus for creativity comes from before the self. And also, there's also a sense in of pure objectivity that is like the self gets out of the way that makes creativity possible. So I think both things are working. I think we see it sometimes in this as creative people need to consolidate or protect themselves as they meet the world, because creativity or raw investigation is a very vulnerable activity. You actually expose yourself in a certain way. But I think the actual engine or impetus to actually see or inquire is actually selfless. I've thrown that out as a possibility.
Yeah, and following up this, I think that you might be right, but it's also a lot of a cultural mindset. Because in other cultures, in other times, even like in medieval time, you have monks or alchemists, or they were able to create extreme beauty without putting their name on it. Like the drive there was just creating beauty and being self-absorbed in this process without putting themselves And actually, all these great words are anonymous. Because behind those, you're not going to put your name, but you have to make beauty. Great philosophers were using false names or common names, because that's the contribution of many people. So it's today, Western culture is strongly driven by this, putting yourself into it. And you need to have this strong drive, but doesn't mean that you need to be a Steve Jobs to be a Steve Jobs.
I think that the greatest artists, from what I observed, create works that are relatable, almost universal, that a lot of people can relate to. I think the artists that aren't as successful are the ones who are so self-centered that they create works that only they feel that they can relate to and put it out there and expect other people to relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was talking about this somewhat related, different, wasn't artists, but anyone, you know, who really pushes the edge. I think there, we came up with it, there's a, there has to be a kind of obsessiveness, you know, that that maybe obviously makes you somewhat eccentric and maybe causes some social friction, and it's how the individual handles that. Some never really...
Like a compensatory thing. You know,
yeah.
If you're strong in this area, you're weak in the other area. Something like that.
Yeah, and like I once had a woman who was, she was a singer, I think, and she said she wanted to be a professional musician. She says, if you're going to be a professional musician, you have to think about it all the time. You know, every when she's walking, which kind of was scary to me as a Buddhist practitioner. I didn't want to be thinking about anything all the time. I say, I mean, you can't just walk through the woods. And, you know. But that kind of, you know, one point of dedication, maybe I could see how that could create, easily leads into self-absorption.
There was a well-known teacher named Soen Roshi, who was one of the first teachers in America. I was really lucky. I heard him in the 70s when he came to visit San Francisco Zen Center. Do you meet Soen Roshi? Soen Roshi was asked, someone came to meet him in a like Dokusan situation, an individual interview. And this Zen student said, "Soen Roshi, I'm really discouraged. I'm really discouraged." It's kind of like Jacinda Williams saying, you know, all this stuff. "I'm really discouraged. What should I do?" And Soen Roshi said, "Encourage others." Isn't that a great answer? Get out of yourself and meet the world in all its glory.